to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Thank you so much for listening, guys. Welcome. Happy to be here.
And Red Powell.
Hello, hello.
We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. Thank you for joining us. If you're listening to the show right now, know that I'm going to be doing a little bit of alteration to the feed. It should be absolutely seamless to you. You shouldn't notice it at all, but I'm going to be making a change on the back end in a little bit, maybe in a week or so, that may affect the show auto-populating in your reader, aggregator, whatever. It shouldn't. Everyone says it shouldn't. The internet tells me that it shouldn't, but I just want to say it right now that you may have to find us again if it goes a couple of weeks and you don't see us. I promise we will be publishing a show every week, so if for some reason you don't get it in a week, you know to look for it again. Again, should be seamless, should be no issues, but I just want to mention it just in case. Sorry, a little bit of housekeeping at the very beginning of the show.
Fair enough. Sounds innovative. Sounds like you're trying to do and mix it up a bit, do some exciting things.
Well, we'll see, right? Check out the website if you have not already. That thing is, we're updating it. Got some things. Going to put some lists up there that we've been working on. These are like homebrew, complete homebrews. Things that we think might be interesting to play and for all types of factions. So if you just want like a starting point or want to, food for thought, go check out the website pretty soon. ForgeNarrative.net. So on this episode, I would like to talk about psychic powers, a little bit of psychic powers, and that's going to lead us into a little bit of Xeno's conversation, maybe talking about Tyranids, maybe talking about Drukhari. See where the conversation leads us. I think it'd be interesting to talk about psychic powers and if you need to mount a psychic defense. Like, do you need to really have something in your army that can compete on against psychic powers? And my initial thought is yes, absolutely. I'm not trying to give away the conclusion. So this is what I think, because we talked previously about how dominant Magnus can be, especially coming in turn three, with only two turns, him controlling all the momentum and getting super powered up. And then, 1,000 points now, over 1,000 points, like 1,100 points of 20 paladins in a Grey Knight army is going to be something that people can easily throw on the table.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are coming at this perspective on psychic, thinking that psychic armies are going to decline simply because we know now, it's been all but confirmed, that both Thousand Suns and Grey Knights are not going to be able to consistently spam their smites without the price point of the smite going off increasing, yeah?
I haven't seen that, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, yeah. Right now, as it stands right now, they don't have it.
Right. So it was in a chapter approved, and we haven't seen it added in necessarily. Mm. And so that's definitely something to look forward to see if that gets added back or not.
So I don't want to speak horrendously out of turn, but I've had it confirmed to me that it probably won't be added back in. I don't know if that's going to be a big bombshell on the community, but it was on another program, and then it was confirmed to me when I messaged somebody else, and they said, yeah, it's most likely not going to get added back in, or they haven't seen any evidence of getting added back in. I think the omission speaks a lot for the direction that and how well thought out 9th edition is, because I think those mechanics on a shorter board where it's unavoidable getting out of range of some of those things, it becomes really really damaging to the game and to the interactive of the of two opponents. Like, you could just play the mass smite, e.g. what we had, the T-Sun's Nurgle demon soup that we had that was prevalent by so many players in 8th edition. That could become really erroneous, because there's no way after turn one, after that army moves up its first turn, there might be no way to avoid those smites anymore. You can't get out of line of sight from them due to the way obscuring works, and you can't maneuver around on a shorter board enough to stop yourself copying 20 mortal wounds a turn. So I think if G-Dub has done this on purpose, I think it's a really clever choice.
It's a way to balance the game. I mean, the whole, what is it, the psychic discipline or something that is, I can't remember the exact rule of only one per thing. I mean, that's a toggle that can be adjusted. And I like the fact that they've proven that they will mess with that. So, I mean, you could be right on. But okay, with that in mind, though, granted, with things like Iron Hands, you had the stratagem. And with Eldar, or Eldari, you basically, your HQs are typically psychers anyway. So the armies that needed to pack something specifically like psychic defense, like Necrons, or I guess maybe Tyranids even come with it innately also, do you need to, is it, should it be a concern? Should you, 'cause sometimes I take like Mephiston. just because he happens to also be a psyker.
Mm.
Just for that, yeah, deny the witch.
Yeah, and he's got a librarian's hood already, and denies it a -1 +1 when he's in the thick of it and he's nice and close, and that's where you want him as well. He's an absolute butcher, so you want to throw him at people's faces.
I do think of it as like his psychic defense is almost like an afterthought. I mean, I don't have to I don't have to take him necessarily for that. He comes with the psychic defense, and he's also a beast. I'm talking about armies that may not have something like that, a go-to, a gimme, or whatever, that they have to actually invest in. Is it worth considering in these early days of army design?
So I think a big thing to think in regards of what you're talking about in regards of defense and everything is that if you end up playing against someone that doesn't have psychic, so like you said, Paul, in regards of Mephiston, you brought him, he's got that nice benefit of the psychic hood and his ability to deny. However, if your opponent, let's say you're playing against, Necrons or Tau or someone who doesn't have psychic, or their army, they just didn't choose to bring psychic, you now have the utility in playing the missions to be able to choose. You can actually lean that psyker character or, whichever psyker element towards a psychic action, and that for your secondaries and mission construction. And so that there's some flexibility to that, where I think that there is a lot of weight towards bringing it. I know that's kind of a segue. I'll let you continue, Adam, but I did want to say, I thought that was a really good point of flexibility.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be a mistake for people to walk into this edition thinking psychic wasn't going to be powerful still. I think it's going to change its form. It's going to morph in what we notoriously have used it for. Because in all honesty, a lot of the time, the psyche phase was used to either, if you were Eldar, usually it was a combination of buffing and dealing damage, like you push through a couple of smites and then an executioner, then your doom and your jinx and your thing. But the doom and the jinx was the value for the psychic. The mortal wounds was the bonus. Whereas T-Sons, that's flipped on its head. The mortal wounds are the buy-in and the buffs are the bonus. And if you look at, I think you might see a fundamental flipping there. I mean, I think armies like T-Sons still have enough direct damage powers that they can still function as a damage-dealing psychic army, no issues. Armies like Grey Knights is where I think it might get a bit more interesting. Grey Knights legitimately have a good swathe of buffs, and a lot of the time they don't get used. Like, I can tell you the amount of times people haven't bothered using Hammerhand on their paladins because they're just like, well, they're just going to kill whatever they go into anyway. But now you're just like, oh, well, I've got the extra powers, nothing else to do it for. They might as well get Hammerhand and double down on my insurance of finishing this job or whatever it is they've got for them. So I think we're going to see a lot more diverse psychic powers in use. We're not just going to see, oh, yep, this guy's got two damage powers, this guy's got two damage powers, this guy can have two damage powers, this guy can have one and a buff. It's going to be pretty diversified, which I think is good. And I like the idea of a more interactive psychic phase rather than just being like, okay, this smite, you wait, other than I've got my one deny, I'm just waiting for them to roll the first low roll on their 2d6 for their smite. There's the first six they roll on their smites, I'll try and deny that one. And if they roll anything above a six, or they got +1s and stuff, I just ignore it.
That's part of what I wanted to at least get us where in a conversation is, if an army is dedicated to casting psychic powers, can they just take so many to where your one deny that you may be able to muster isn't really worth considering to begin with?
Doesn't make any meaningful impact. Yeah, I think that is a thing. But I think like I don't want to say you'd be a fool, but I think you'd be mistaken in thinking that you shouldn't have one pocket deny most of the time if you're going to a tournament. Like, just because some guy's going to have 20 possessed and he needs to warp time, and you're like, I need to have the option to interact with that, or I'm going to get steamrolled. I think that's something people should absolutely plan for, because it's going to be a real feel bad. You're like, oh, well, I could have taken this deny strat, or I could have taken this assassin or this inquisitor or this Mephiston or whatever, and you're like, nah, I chose to take this other dude instead. Oh, cool, I lost. You know, this guy got one power off and just.
But that's putting
me.
So much faith in one. You know, being in one, you've got to be in range. Then you've got they've got to roll a number that's attainable for you, and then you've got to roll to stop it.
Yeah, sometimes look, the deny strats, the 4+ to deny strats, have actually never been worse, because you could, from was my understanding, that you can no longer re-roll the 4+. When you try and deny a power, that being things like the Iron Hands have that, one of the AdMech guys have it. It's pretty prevalent.
Yeah, the command point reroll is now completely defined, and it doesn't say your one-off strategy to deny the witch. Yeah.
Exactly. So they've never kind of felt worse now, because, I mean, sometimes you'd have that 4+ to deny, you'd fail it, and you'd be like, well, I'm going to lose if I don't
Yeah, if I don't get this warp time denied, plus, then it's game over anyway. Might as well
hell to pay. Exactly right. So, yeah, I may have the opinion that they've never felt worse, but look, you know what the lay of the land. Everyone knows what the lay of the land was going into 9th edition, and psychic was a significant portion of the game. And going into 9th thinking it's just going to completely drop off, I think that's a mistake. It might not be anywhere near as brutal as it was, but I still think you're going to want that ability to stop that doom on your key unit, or like I said, yeah, warp time being the best example.
Yeah, it's one of those things to where I guess you can get kind of caught in circular logic, but like if the board is smaller and denies are always in range, that means I'm not going to take psychers because they're always going to have defense within range. And so they never take defense because you never take the psychers, and then somebody shows up with all the psychers.
Yeah, that's actually really true. I guess, well, some armies don't have the choice. Like I said, with T-Suns, like I said, with especially with Tyranids as well, you can't really take a Tyranid. You can't take a Tyranid HQ that's not a Psyker apart from a Tyranid Prime. And so you've already got this investment, so you might as well get some mileage out of it. I guess that's the assumption. But yeah, I actually see where you're coming from. That is a good point. People are always going to be in denial. So maybe then we're talking about whether or not you need to take things that double down on your buffs, like the plus one, like Ironman's got his plus one to cast and things of that ilk, Magnus. We know Magnus is a bit of a beast in the psychic phase. Maybe we're just looking at really powerful psychers, or having so many psychic powers you can just force through things when you need it.
Like a ton of demon princes. I mean, they're going to be always threats, but you know they also are just kind of inherently psychers. I mean, not yours, Red. You know, but the rest of ours.
That's right. That's right.
you got any perspectives on that, Red? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with what you said in regards that you always. I mean, you know, there's certain events, team events maybe, where you can skew one way or the other, you know, in regards of psychic preparation. But I completely agree in regards that you need to always expect that there's going to be an army out there that whether it hinges on it or it can absolutely take advantage of the fact if you aren't bringing psychic powers into play, right? So this whole game has a combined arms concept to it. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, we've talked before about the difficulty of being a pure range or a pure melee, you know, leaning one way or the other. And so to a point, ignoring a phase of the game, you know, some armies unfortunately can't help it. And you'd like to hope or think that the, you know, you look at Tau or Necrons who don't have psychic phases, and you hope they have something that allows them to kind of make up for that. And I'd argue, at least for Tau, I mean, if anybody's played a couple games of 9th edition in stark contrast to 8th edition, you know, Tau, their ability to overwatch without having to pay CP is huge, right? That's massive. Mm-hmm. However, when we get into the psychic concept, that's an entire other phase. And there are, you know, you mentioned like Thousand Suns, and there's just ways that those factions can really take advantage of the game in certain ways by applying themselves. And so you really got to figure out, you know, what you're bringing and what you're doing. I mean, even, you know, Dark Eldar, I mean, one of my, you know, now you can't do it in 9th edition, but back when we could change out relics beforehand, you know, if I knew I was going up against psychers and I didn't have any psychic capability myself, I would probably bring a relic or something that gave me that flexibility. And now you got to go into it thinking like, you know, maybe you should just settle for that to a certain extent.
So with the relic picking, I mean, is that all done pre-game in your list building to where you can't even alter that now when you get to the table?
That's right. Yep, it's going. I mean, out of the book, it's everything is preset. So your relic, outside of paying the stratagem, I believe for the new relics. And Adam, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think I know your free relic is selected beforehand.
That's brutal.
But I can't remember if you have to pay the stratagem and if that's preset or not. But
I'm pretty sure you have to pay the stratagems pre-game. I'm not sure you have to have selected the relics. I'm still waiting to get some definitive word on that. Yeah, I know things like the Warlord traits. If you want an extra Warlord trait, that has to be noted on your list. So I'd assume the relics would be as well, just based on that, seeing as they're both in the same codex and written at the same time. But yeah, there's still some ifs and buts there, so there still needs to be some definitive answers. I'm pretty sure like the first couple of tournaments will show us the way pretty much.
Right.
They'll show us what the standards are supposed to be.
Things are a little bit different when you're playing with a buddy. I mean, you kind of know, hey, what do you bring in? I mean, although it is kind of fun to show up with the blind list sometimes.
Absolutely. And yeah. then you have your fallback of, he tailored for me because I didn't know what he was taking. He knew what I was taking.
Oh, I love the crutch. Loses, yeah, like, I love the crutch talk. That's like, oh, he knew I didn't have any this or that or whatever.
Yeah. He knew I wasn't bringing any of the new Melter guys that we brought in knights. And yeah.
He brought out all his, obscuring terrain. I couldn't even see him for 3 turns.
Question for Red. So you talk about combined arms approaches a lot, and you, for those who don't know, Red is are you a colonel or a major?
I'm only a major.
Only a major in the biggest army in existence. In theaters of war, contextually, whatever you're able to divulge or give us insight into, would you ever go into a theater of war where
he always did? I'm sorry.
That's fantastic. Leave an asset at home when you have the ability to take it? Like when you have the ability to take it, and you even though you know you might not need it in every theater that you're attending during this battle, would you still take every asset you could?
Yeah. So there's to be fair, Adam, that's kind of a loaded question, right?
Yeah, it is totally.
Because I'll just say, up front that when you fight, in this sense, especially in an existential sense, you fight to win and you fight to survive, right? And so if you are in that mindset in a much more realistic sense, you're playing for keeps, right? You're playing to win and you're playing to survive at the best possible margin. And so that kind of steps a little bit outside of our spirit of the game to a certain extent, because it's at that point, I'm not necessarily concerned about whether or not you're enjoying yourself. And so when it comes down to that, I'm going to bring, it would be ideal to bring absolutely every single thing that you can in order to ensure that you do that. Right. Now, there's some other elements to that in regards of, the elements of operational art in regards of if I'm doing this over time and I'm tying tactical execution to strategic objectives. There's certain ways in how I want to do things and how I phase it so that it's operationally placed. And because you don't want to culminate too soon, right? You don't want to go into an event or something. And fortunately, in most tournament settings, it's not necessarily to the extent that, your wins or how you won is as dependent upon your next game and so on and so forth. It's not like you play a game with 2,000 points and then the next game you're only playing with what you kept alive from the first game or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. So you're not having to worry about that as much. However, to put it in terms of tournament play and whatnot, you do score points, right? And points kind of determine your degree of success. And so if we take the 9th edition system for how you score points, to an extent, you've kind of got to be aware in a more operational sense of, well, I scored only 60 points. I might have won in the last game, but I only scored 60 points. And there's someone out there who won and scored 90 points, for example. Mm. And so now in the next game or the game after that, but to get back to your point, so that what I was just talking about, those were some operational goals and the tactical goals in the combined arms sense. If you're going to win, and again, that I don't want to step too far outside of the spirit of the game in this context, you should absolutely be prepared to bring what you need in order to fight, win, and survive. And if that's what you're going for.
I thought you were going to bore it up with some logistics talk. So I guess it's up to me. I got to bore it up.
I was about to say, despite that being a very loaded question, I think that was a very amazing answer. Thanks very much, Red.
Absolutely amazing answer. I think part of the logistics of building your army list, though, is we have points to contend with, and only insert so many resources, relics to spend, CPs to spend, points to spend, and then you've got to make some. So it's not you don't. I'm not trying to say anything, but like a real world military has to deal with that in some way as well, and maybe that's the situation that your pretend army is in that day.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to your point, Paul, and you're right, so points are the abstract representation of logistics in this game, right?
Yep.
It's what you can logistically support into the field of battle, And that you're absolutely right. And to a point, you know, detachment constraints and the CP and, you know, all of those are abstractions of really kind of the background logistics to the game. And so you're right. Like, you know, you sit there and you look at what you got and what you can bring. And so, you know, you put that in a real world context. You can't bring tanks to the fight unless you have fuel, unless you have ammo. They don't drive unless they can guzzle, you know, about 16 to 30 gallons just turning them on. And so, you know, it's a whole other thing. But so, you know, of course, again, the points are our abstractions in regards to logistics. And it's absolutely right in regards of, well, I can only bring so many of this. And if I'm going to pay the CP for, you know, it does get kind of, I mean, even playing around with list building here at ninth. Okay, if I bring a patrol, I mean, I know I'm not going to be able to bring more than two of, you know, a heavy option or a fast option or something like that. Like, you're definitely constrained to a certain extent. But if you go as far as bringing a brigade and you put out the CP to do that, then you've almost got a reverse constraint in the regards that you have to bring six troops. You have to bring three, you know, elite, fast attack, and heavy. And that constraint is something else entirely in the regards that you have to find something like you have to make sure your efficiency of points fills that, right? So that's a really good point in regards to the abstraction and how you weigh out points and what you need to accomplish in regards to certain missions.
And we almost went narrative there for a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool though. This is great. I mean, this is a as far as exceeded the expectations of talking about whether or not you need a psyker. And I think that's, this is fabulous.
Well, I mean, and it's to Adam's point. I mean, you know, if you know the other person has it, right? So this has been the constant, I mean, in a historical context, as history has gone on, there's constantly been revolutions of military affairs. And it's where these, you know, someone brings something new to the fight. And so, and everybody's, you know, if you're going to play in a game at your local meta, your local tournament store, and you know what, you know, if you know someone there has Thousand Sons, like, how are you going to counter that, right? It's just like what Adam was saying in regards of understanding what the other person's going to bring. If you know you are going to a bigger event and you know there's going to be a wider range, I mean, you can go on, you know, all the sorts of groups online or, you know, listen to some more of what we've got to say in regards of what people are doing and what's cool out there and whatnot. But probably someone's going to have some psychic capability. And how are you going to mitigate that? You know, I mean, like you mentioned with Korn, I didn't have that capability. Nobody in Korn has psychic, you know, there are no psychers because Korn hates them. However, I did have stratagems and relics that I could bring to essentially fight that back. And it was effective to a point. I mean, I'll take the stratagem, which is just, you know, similar to like what Black Templar have, roll on a four up and it automatically denies the stratagem. I'll take that 50% roll. But that, again, I had to factor in that I had something to fight it back because otherwise there wasn't going to be anything else.
Well, in your local game stores, when tournaments kick back up, I mean, or if you're playing in a smaller group of people, you can actually plan within a reasonable assurance of what you have the possibility of facing. You know, what you're going to face That's in round right. two, what you're going to face in round three. You kind of know, especially if you're dealing with, you know, 10, 12 people or whatever that you play with. In a major or a huge event, several hundred people, you know, outside of just the clear, like Iron Hands menace, you know, that we were in with this with this last set of you know, round of codexes or whatever. It's a crapshoot, so you really can get away with taking more, I think. But Adam, I think you hit it on the head earlier about having that pocket psyker if you can. Like if you can get away with it without too much of a tax, then there's even if you don't plan on being offensive with it, there's probably typically like a buff or something you can do, or you know. Or a debuff that you can enhance another unit with in the psychic trees. Like the psychic trees are, I think, rich enough to where you're probably not often like hamstringing or reducing your effectiveness if you take a psyker in your army.
I want to point out that notoriously, unless it was two super psychic armies, e.g. things like Eldar versus Nids or T-Suns versus Grey Knights or any combination of those, your single point of psychic defense usually wasn't being used to stop a psychic power. Sorry, an offensive psychic power, unless it was a super smite. and you could just 4+ shut it down. Usually most of the time you were saving them for a buff, a buff or a debuff that was going to negatively impact or significantly change the game. Because in all reality, when you're playing against T-Suns, you look at them, you look at their list, and you're like, you already like calculate, all right, I'm going to take X amount of smites per turn. But the smites aren't going to beat you because that's their equivalent of shooting. You were going to take that same damage versus Imperial Guard or versus Gunline Space Marines, you know? That's already kind of calculated. But it's the X Factor stuff, the stuff that fundamentally changes the layout and the dynamics of the game. Things of the ilk of Doom, yeah, and of Jinx, of sometimes Catalyst for, or turning off Overwatch mechanics for GSC. What's the one where they go super, Might from Beyond? Things of that ilk. Things that fundamentally change the way you have to conceptualize the battle. Those are the things you usually save that pocket for. And I think that reason is still there in 9th edition. I don't think that's changed whatsoever.
Like a quicken or something. You just have it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In your back pocket. And in some armies, you can get away with it almost basically for free. And, you know, like in Guard, a primary psyker is 50 points.
Yep, and you're already probably taking him to buff some tank commanders or some Bulgrin of some kind. You've already got an Astropath or two. Like, it's already there. So why wouldn't you just double down and ensure you're going to have it when you need it?
Yeah, and he denies basically the same weight, 24 inches, that anybody outside of Magnus does.
Yeah, and so I will say Tau, to my knowledge, don't have any ability to turn off a psychic power. They don't have any single, they don't have a 4+ deny. They may have a Warlord trait that I've completely forgotten about that gives them one deny a turn or something.
I thought there was a 5+ or something. I mean, maybe I'm thinking about from a previous edition also, but they make up for shooting.
Yeah.
Free Overwatch.
Free Overwatch. But look, they're the only one I think might be a little bit hard done by in the buffs and debuffs section, just because if they have no ability to interact with those powers, they do just tend to run away with it a little bit. But we know how well Tau is able to adapt to things and how flexible their standard like core units are. And I'm hoping those core units expand. Like, if we want to jump into a bit of
we'll take a break here in a second.
Discussion.
Yeah, but like Tau, I mean, they're one of their only quote unquote drawbacks was their mid range. I mean, they're a 24 to 36 inch army for the most part. Now that doesn't even, nobody cares. But that's the game now.
That's the best range. Yeah. That's all you need.
All right, let's take a break. Thanks for that wonderful discussion. We'll come back and we'll talk. Yeah, promise we'll talk Xenos.
Sounds good.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back, ready to dive deep into the Maw of the Warp, the ever-churning devourer, Tyranids.
Yeah, so Tyranids are in an interesting place going into this edition. I think there has been a general consensus by a lot of people out there, a lot of you out there, thinking that the way that they're fundamentally played is going to change, simply because a lot of people believe that they're a Horde army and that they're not this great dynamic army, that this one build and that's their best build and they're only going to function like that. And that they're going to be exposed to blast weapons and the board changing, the coherency changes and all these things are going to be negative for them. I still think they've got a hell of a lot of meat on the bone. I don't know about you guys.
Art, do you think Exocrines are good? Because that's really...
Look, Exocrines, Biovores, Hive Guard, stupendous. All very good units. Where people seem to, so a lot of you out there have said there might be some issues, is more in their troops choices. Termagants, you know, they're all minimum 10 mans. Like Termagants, minimum 10 mans. Hormagants are the same. Gene Stealers are the same. Are Gene Stealers 10 mans or are they 5 mans?
They can be 5 mans. Gene Stealers 5 mans.
Yeah,
5 to
yeah,
10
yeah. I had a feeling they had. And then they got Rippers. So a lot of people are saying, oh, why don't we just spam Rippers and everything will be okay. But that's that can get exposed in its own ways. I think people are overlooking the humble Tyranid Warrior here. And I've got a lot of love for the Tyranid Warriors.
So they've had, I think, some varying degree of rating over the course of this past two editions. And, you know, there were some like fringe cases of being able to bring him in out of the hole of a, the burrow or
thing? Trigon.
Yeah, they come up from after that. I don't want to breeze past the Gene Stealers. I think the Gene Stealers are phenomenal for 15 points a model.
Me too.
But a three-man squad of Tyranid Warriors for 60, base 63 points for three Tyranid Warriors.
I think that's pretty good, man. It's 9 wounds of toughness 4. Taking them is it Leviathan? They get the 6+ feel no pain. They got 2 saves. There are a lot of layers of buffs you can put on them now, both in shooting and defensively. Some of those in their codex, some of them from Psychic Awakening. I think they're pretty well placed to be a versatile unit going into 9th edition.
Well, I mean, they do have the option for ranged weapons or close combat loadouts. Yeah.
Well, each one of them can take a heavy bolter, essentially. Or you can take some baby las cannons and master the venom cannon or the barb strangler. There's a lot of versatility there, I think. On top of that, you can kit these guys out to be pretty respectable melee units as well. They can be almost as scary as gene stealers, if not more scary, if you're willing to put the points into them. And that means, like, you know, you've got to buy a Tyranid Prime and get some psychic support as well. But I think it's a very versatile core unit. And I like the idea of a lot of Tyranid army starting with a brick of these guys with the minus two, so the ignoring minus two rend. I love the idea of that. I think it's a very good meaty unit you can build around.
I apologize in advance. I had no idea what a Tyranid Prime cost points wise from the previous edition, but now it's 75 points.
Yep, he gives them plus one ballistic skill, weapon skill. And he's not a slouch in combat himself, you know, but that's all he pretty much is. Unfortunately, like, he's not a psyker. Every Tyranid warrior is already synapsed, so they didn't need him for that. As a little like pocket buffer, I think he's pretty cool. Like, if you were going to take a big unit of Tyranid warriors, I think you'd go down that route. And in all honesty, I still think you can go down the horde route. You just can't. I would only take 10 mans, and I would spam 10 mans. Like, you take a brigade. Yeah, you take maybe.
10 man unit of Hormagaunts, base points 60 points. That is pretty much for free. I mean, we were talking about a 5-point grot for orcs.
Yeah. And one extra point.
Yeah, 5-point guardsmen, essentially. You're getting one point for, I mean, I think marginally better for what you can do with it, like offensively with the Hormagaunts.
They are so much faster. They got that 6-inch consolidate, which I can't tell you how flexible and crazy that is in the right hands. Like, you can do so much janky stuff with that. They're so much quicker. They're actually not bad in combat for a 6-point model. They're actually respectable in combat, like, comparatively, seeing as you can get three of these essentially for the price of one intercessor now. How many more attacks has the Hormagaunts got? And they move faster. Admittedly, they have no save. Like, they are literally cockroaches.
I mean, I guess we all know that guy who rolls hot with his gene stealers. Like, yes, that just happens. But yeah, most things, and I mean, even what Tyranid Warriors, aren't they like a 4+ save? Am I remembering that right?
No, they're 4+ save.
Yep. Yeah, so yep. I mean, that's basically no save to what you would encounter. Although I do want to talk about, like, I know we're not talking about Marines, but I think Marines with the Devastator Doctrine being turn one and then everything being able to go into reserves is functionally much, much worse. And so all the things that you want to shoot with las cannons or want to shoot with your extra AP or whatever won't be on the table because you can hide them a lot easier now, either through reserves, through everybody getting reserves spending the CP, or just some innate ability of the units. So, you know, Marines are taking a step down as far as that goes. I know they're getting a research, you know, a refresh of some killer units, but like Devastator Doctrine was super powerful for a lot of things in the previous edition, and now it's going to take a big hit, like, just with the way the game functions now. So what I was just going to say about the Tyranid Warrior's armor basically being tinfoil, maybe that's not so much a factor anymore.
And a lot of the, I don't know about you, if you guys are keeping up with a lot of amazing content creators we've got at the moment putting out 9th edition games. I'm sure many of you out there have engaged with that and watched it. But you can see that with the way the terrain works now, you've never been more, apart from maybe 5th edition, you've never been more able to avoid damage turn one. And if you're playing against some erroneous sit back and shoot Space Marine army, just like, well, I guess I'm just not going to let you shoot anything good turn one, am I, brother? we'll start the game on turn two. Here we go.
It's real. I mean, I guess the reason I'm mentioning is because I think it's challenging my perception of what's good. You know, I could look at things before and I'm like, ugh, I just, you know, if I don't have an invul or if I don't have, a 3+ save that I could somehow get down to a 2+, then, you know, what am I even doing? And now it's opened up. I mean, for a combination of things, you were talking about points, terrain, board size, like it is a radically different game.
I absolutely agree. And I think you have to leave some of your 8th edition at the door, but you got to take some of it with you. And the things you have to take with you is the context of what armies do. Armies are still going to play the same. Sorry, they're still going. You're still going to see the same things. The things that are powerful in 8th edition are going to be powerful in 9th edition, apart from maybe some of the ones that got hit really hard in the points. Fingers crossed, Centurions. We don't see 18 Centurions anymore. That'd be a lovely world. But you got to take some of it with you, but leave some of it at the door. Like Tyranid Warriors, yeah? No one would have even looked at them last edition and been like, oh, yeah, that's good. I mean, maybe they had some fringe cases when they got their Psychic Awakening before other armies got their Psychic Awakening, because admittedly, they didn't get a lot. I thought they were going to get, and I hoped that they were going to get a lot more, something that would fundamentally change the feel of the game. But all it did was give them some power units. Like, it took the Exarchon from being a fringe, very, very fringe unit you take one of maybe in a specific list to, wow, this is actually an amazing unit. It does so much work for me. And in 9th edition, it can move and shoot with and spend a CP to not care and not take the minus ones and all these other amazing things. Oh, sorry, it's a monster. It always doesn't take the minus ones. But you know what I mean? It's got so many more options there. And I think there's a huge, awesome lease on life that needs to getting at the moment. Things like Tyrannifexes. When was the last time you heard anybody talk about a Tyrannifex, guys?
Is that the one that can burrow up and has all the shooting? Like it's got the maw that it spits at people or something?
That's the Moloch.
Oh.
Yeah, there's the Moloch, there's the Hierospex. The Tyrannifex is the big shooty, the other build for the Tervagon.
This is like a nightmare from, I don't know, like 10 episodes ago when I couldn't remember the name of that giant bug. I'm like, it looks so cool. Like, come on. But you've never seen one.
Yeah, exactly. I think I played against them twice in the last edition and a couple of times in 7th, and that was it. But now, like, they're legit when they can shoot into combat. You can just ram those guys like a actual legitimate battering ram, like what you think a Carnifex used to be. Ram it in there. Oh, I've got acid spray. I've got a flamer. I've got a salvo launcher, whatever. You can either run away or stay here and burn, you know, or stay in combat with me and burn. I think that's a lot of good pressure. And plus, they don't do that much in combat, so people aren't going to be hugely threatened by them. But they're relatively cheap for the amount of toughness 8 wounds you get, and you just ram them down people's throat and just make them squirm. I think it's cool.
I'm really thinking about these Tyranid Warriors. I know I'm jumping back a second, but I mean, they do, like, the more I think about it, that might be a good solid base, because you know, if we are still on the path that more smaller footprint units are objectively better, mm-hmm. then these just nestle right in there.
I think so. And I think if you wanted to, and you wanted to dodge, dodge the blast changes, dodge the coherency change, you could just take a couple of five-mans. Take two or three five-man warrior units, bundle them up around a buffing Psyker or Tyranny Prime, Swarm Lord, whatever you feel like. And yeah, it's not a bad core to build around. But I, at the same time, like if you wanted to add in some 10-man Termagant Hormagant units or some Rippers, because I think Rippers are amazing, I think they're also good choices. It's not all doom and gloom for that troop choice, I think. I think there's a lot more to get stuck into there. People just focusing on the negatives. And I think that you can still get a lot of mileage out of it.
Well, I think you're right there, is that you need the smaller 10-man units because they can scurry about. They also, I mean, they're shorter. You know, I mean, there's some physics about those models that I think will really benefit. And you can, I mean, even a 10-man unit on 25-millimeter bases is not incredibly big, you know, real estate-wise. And you're going to be wanting to hold objective, and you're going to want to be able to go out and maybe run something, or even surround a character model or Venom Throw, you know, or something. You know, you want to you want to use them for the base, the real estate they can take up, while you have these other Tyranid Warrior type units going up there and doing some business. I mean, I think it's going to be a toss up between them and the Gene Stealers, but that requires some playing with, I guess. I'm curious what actually plays out, how it comes together.
And so a fundamental tactic I think might become a core thing for Tyranid players is using Metabolic Override on a 10-man unit you don't care about. Like 10-man Termagant unit, 50 points. A Metabolic Override, for those who don't know, is you get to move again, but you roll a dice, and on a 1, you lose a guy. The unit takes a mortal wound. And you roll a dice for each guy in the unit. So 10 dice on every 1. On average, you'll lose 2 dudes. But the fundamental tactic I'm talking about is roadblocking, is speed bumping people. Because if you can get onto an objective first and hold it and then put something in the way of your opponent getting to that objective, that's money in the bank. That's points safe, secure in the bank for you going into the next turn. And so I think Tyranids can do that just as well as Imperial Guard can, because that's something I plan to do. Just double move order, double move guardsmen into people's faces to stop them getting on objectives when I get there first. So I think that's something Tyranid players should look into, hopefully.
And Adam, I'm just catching up to you. So I'm back on the, I'm now to the Tyrannifex.
Love it. Sorry.
That thing is toughness 8, and is it still 14 wounds?
I think it's up there. It's between 12 and 14.
So that means that the giant model can hide behind obscuring terrain.
It can, mate. It's not 18 wounds. Yep. You can hide that big boy.
So you can slink this dude up and have him come in with his, stinger salvos. So I mean, I take stinger salvos, but
acid spray is the one people are talking about at the moment.
2d6, d3 damage, auto hits, 18 inch range.
Shoots twice if he moves under half, or is it twice when he stands still?
The weapon beast. If this model does not move in your movement phase, it can shoot all of its weapons twice in your shooting phase.
E.g., if you're in combat with somebody in your shooting phase, you just 4d6 them. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Ruined.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. And that's without buffs. I mean, I know the toxin sacks and the adrenal glands. I think that gives it.
So toxin sacks, that gives another damage, I think, on sixes in combat. And adrenaline glands, I think, is plus one advance and charge, I believe. Could be wrong there, though.
No, that sounds right. Yeah. I don't mind this. On a T8... 3 plus save.
Yep. I think they're pretty good. I think they've got some work now. And even if you wanted to play a defensive tyrannid list, one or two of these guys just as problem solvers, like if someone who chucks some, you're playing against Red chucks two units of Khorne Berserkers in them, and you manage to tap and get those guys to tapped in combat and roadblock them with a Tyrannifex because they'd go straight through the Termagants and it wouldn't make a difference. He can legitimately stop them. And then you're going to make Berserkers fall back. Red's just going to be psychologically put off by that. He's going to be like, I refuse to fall back. I'm world eaters. We don't do that. And then you just get sprayed to death.
You could functionally surround this guy with the gaunts and people couldn't get to it. You would get to be able to do your acid spray. Like you have to move if they're up there. And then again, like you said, roadblocked, and then it gets to acid spray for 4d6 and then charge something, whatever's left.
Yeah, and on top of that, he has got the pocket stinger salvo, which I think is just a heavy bolter. It's 4-shot heavy bolter.
It is. Strength 5 minus 1. 5, neg 1.
Yeah.
24 inch range.
It's pretty great. Yeah. And is it 18 inch range on the acid spray?
18, yeah.
Yeah, it's a torrent flamer from ages gone by. It's legitimate. I like it.
The D3 damage is really significant.
It is. It makes intercessors squirm, man, which I like. Anything that bothers space marines is good in my books.
Yeah, and Grey Knights too. I mean, the paladins.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
There's been a lot of talk of Terminators coming back. Remains to be seen, but, two wound models with this many shots, you're going to peel through them with a neg. It's only neg 1 AP, but.
It's compensated by auto hitting because he's got a 4 plus ballistic skill otherwise, but auto hitting just totally gets around that. But, and we are dodging around some of the obviously good choices. Like I said, the Exocrine, the Hive Guard, the Biovores, those things are just, they are just good. Another thing I want to talk about. And I know people are going to cringe when I say this, flying hive tyrants, those massive wings, you might have to bleep, those massive wings that you could never hide behind anything anymore. Well, he's 12 wounds now. You could hide him behind whatever you want.
That's important because that was it. I mean, you knew if you put him on the table, you're going to, because that, okay, I used to have a tenet when I was building army lists. If your faith and hopes and dreams revolved around something that could be killed by a heavy bolter, you probably needed to start over. And the Hive Tyrant was one of those things. The Harpy's one of those things. Like people, it's got all these guns. Like, you could kill it with anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But you bring up a good point.
Yeah, you can hide that sucker now. And his damage output is still legitimate. He's still a beast in combat. He's still a psyker. He's one of the best and most well-rounded units in the game, I think. I'm not quite sure where the points are. Admittedly, I haven't looked at the points. But Flying Hive Tyrant, it's very versatile, and we know how good they are. We know
The Hive Tyrant with wing starts at 200 points. So, I mean, as far as like HQs go, that's not terrible.
That's not terrible, no. And then, of course, you'd have to buy him his guns and his melee weapons and whatnot if you wanted that. But I think he's a very versatile choice, and I think he looks pretty good in this edition.
Yeah,
just because you get the option to not have him die turn one if you go second.
I mean, I am digging, though. I mean, I'm digging the Broodlord still. I'm digging the Gene Stealer still. Mm. I mean, again, maybe that's just because I'm trying to think that way, but I'm also kind of shell-shocked from being on the receiving end of Gene Stealers for going on the better part of 20-something years.
Oh, mate, I think everyone's got is conditioned to be fearful when they hear Gene Stealers. But I think one unit of Gene Stealers, one unit of 20, if you would take, but I the only reason I don't like taking Gene Stealers is because you almost feel like you have to buy that Swarm Lord to make him go. But in a defensive list where you just hold the Stealers as a deterrent, I think it's really good. Because if you're going to buy Swarm Lord and you're like, how many points is he? What, a 200, 300 points?
270.
I'm going to buy a 270 point model walking for a single turn to buff a single unit of Gene Stealers. You're like, well, I guess I'm taking two units of Gene Stealers now because I'm taking Swarmlord to justify his cost. And then all of a sudden, you've got a Gene Stealer army because it's like half your army to take two units of Gene Stealers and Swarmlord.
I don't think you need him anymore. I mean, it used to be, you know, with the tippity tap, you would want a Swarmlord because moving up, triggering something to move again, destroying something, wrapping something, going up and engaging something else. Like those aren't the critical moves anymore.
That's true.
And so I don't know that you want to invest in the Swarmlord for that, unless you're just a particular like Swarmlord enthusiast. You took him for a function, and I don't think that function exists anymore.
Yeah, that's true. And on a shorter board, it's like you said, it's way less relevant. I do want to say Swarmlord is a mad dog. Anybody who cuts off Khalgar's arms is sick. best piece of fluff, that fight. So good.
Hey, that's fair. You make a great case for the Flying High Tyrant. I mean, not that you needed to make a case for the Flying High Tyrant, because it's a staple. I mean, it's got the psychic powers. It's got decent shooting, and you don't really have to. I guess you could technically get also geared up for hand to hand if you wanted to, but I think the psychic buff and the shooting is that, I don't think that's changed.
Yeah,
for what you'd want. But the Broodlord, though, on the other hand, you know, also has some of that. And it gets to run shotgun with these Gene Stealers, which it gets a ton of movement. So, I mean, I think that's gonna win out.
Yeah.
Well, and again, with a lot of this not being, you know, we're not necessarily rushing. Of course, you want to kill, you know, your opponent's army and everything. But to a point, you know, we've talked about board control and the importance of board control in 9th edition. And, you know, talking about Hormigaunts and what they can do and talking about a bunch of small units or even the warriors, right? I mean, like, Adam, you mentioned having warriors and you've talked before about the MMUs, right? Multiple medium units, and having those to sit on objectives, but also just like, you know, Paul was saying with the roadblocks of Hormigaunts, and then to be able to have your kind of your Vanguard Gene Stealers to wrap around one of the sides or something like that to be able to sweep into your opponent's line. And I do think there's a lot of flexibility to the Tyranids, especially because of their synapse and their, you know, they don't take morale tests as long as they're within range. And so those roadblocks just aren't going away. And you don't care if they necessarily, you know, vanish, but they definitely can still serve a purpose. And so there is I do think that the game now with board control almost lends itself a little more towards really enabling the Tyranid player's mindset of having these throwaway pawns because they're fearless. They're going to disrupt the enemy. They're not going away. And all, you know, you need is really one Hormigaunt model to be, or a warrior to be sitting on an objective. And the other model, you know, your opponent's model might not be objective secured and you've got it. And, you know, how many times is that going to come into play, right?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. There is this definitive combined arms approach when it comes to Tyranids, because admittedly, they don't do anything the best that I can think of. They're not the best in combat, even though they're very good. They're not the best at shooting, even though they're quite good. They're not the best at psychic, even though they're very reliable. But a combined arms Tyranid army can do a lot of things very well. And I believe thank you for bringing that up and jogging my memory. MMU is absolutely a way you can play Tyranids. And that army that you build in an MMU style with a couple of medium units of Hive Guard, maybe one big unit if you want to double shoot it, a couple of warriors, rippers, maybe one pocket Steeler unit, and with some synergy, just building around that core, I feel like it can do a lot of things really well. Like I feel like there's a lot of meat on the bone there, especially going into these missions. These missions, I feel like, can be played to Tyranid's favor a lot.
Talking about Gene Stealers still, is the infestation nodes, those things, I think, had a lot of utility in 8th. And now, you know, if an enemy model's ever within 9 inches of an infestation node, the node is destroyed and removed from the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are going to find it a lot easier to get within 9 of those things. So I wouldn't bet
on that. But at the same time, if you want to save a couple of points on strategic reserves, there's an easy way to not spend CP, to spend a couple of points instead. So that could be a thing on a niche play. But yeah, I can't see it being that reliable, because like you said, you play against Raven Guard and they're just like, nah, bruh, turn it off.
Well, I mean, it's free. If your army includes any units of Gene Stealers, you can place up to four infestation nodes anywhere in your deployment zone when your army deploys.
Some reason I still thought they cost like 5 or 10 points.
Maybe I'm tripping. Thing. I mean, I don't. But I think this one's free.
Sick.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, something to do there. You're right. There is some play here in the Tyranids, and that's kind of there's everything. Things are open.
But yeah, it's wide open.
But I mean, the Tyranids may be kind of uniquely poised because they have strong melee and then just the casual Deny the Witches. So you're not really going to be outmatched. You're going to have tools in your toolbox for whatever you come against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like they've got some playability in every phase, and I like that because it's the opposite of say Necrons and Tau. Tau obviously they have their one super phase. They play a very good movement phase, and they play a ridiculously good shooting phase and a very good Overwatch phase. Tyranids can do every phase. You might not be a standout, super crazy, insane in every phase or in any one phase, but the fact that you have the option and the ability to play in all four of them to a really dynamic and good ability, I think it's a very good general's army.
I think they had a somewhat linear path to efficiency before, and we don't know what any of those efficiencies are right now, you know, at least how it plays out. We don't have enough reps with it, but just far as is the how the point increases were kind and unkind to certain codexes, I think the Tyranids have come out okay with it.
I think so too.
We'll see, but I know I used to really enjoy seeing Warriors on the table. I do, again, showing my age, remember squaring up against some of the original Warriors.
Yes.
And that came in that Tyranid Attack box set and stuff. I know they've changed a lot, but you know, now there's the big-headed Warrior, and then they got the weird-looking weapon Warrior. See, no one knows what any of this stuff is.
It's because they've all got big heads and weird weapons, mate.
But I think, yeah, you might be onto something. I mean, for less than 80 points, you're going to have, what is that, 12 wounds with functionally in cover, a 3+ save, and then other ways to buff them. People are going to try to have to find ways to manage that while they're also dealing with your Gene Stealers or Hormigaunts, or you've made me a believer of the Tyranifex.
Nice. Good. I'm happy. But comparatively, I don't do... A lot of you out there don't like it when we do cross-faction comparisons. But an interesting one to know is points per wound. It's like a Space Marine Intercessor is 10 points per wound, 20 points per model. How many points is it for a single Tyranid Warrior?
21 points.
21 points. He's got 3 wounds, a toughness 4. So he's essentially the same as the Intercessor, but he's got an extra wound. One less save 4+, save 3+. But wounds are one of the best fundamental mechanics you can build a list around. Like, I mean, I know...
That is 7 points per wound, so that is 30% better. I mean, it's got one less save, so those wounds are less... We're going to call it 20% better than an Intercessor.
But comparatively, you said it was 60-odd points, yeah? For 3 Tyranid Warriors.
63 points for 3 Tyranid Warriors with no weapons. You know, that's just bug naked.
Yeah, it's butt naked. So the same on Space Marines, the same amount of wounds. That's 12 wounds of Warriors. 12 wounds of Space Marines comes in 120. Twice the amount of points. Same toughness four, 12 wounds, 12 wounds, 60 points, 120 points. I think there might be something in that. Like
it's
if
worth
you
trying.
Wanted to take it might not be good, it might not be great, but it's a thing. It's a thing that you can comparatively look, points per wound, points per wound. This actually shapes up okay to one of the best armies in the game and one of the best units in the game.
I think you're going to need people on the table, like bodies on the table, and then those stack up really well. I mean, again, they could do things. You could play the I'm going to shoot from 36-inch range with a couple of guns. Can you equip all the Warriors with guns?
Yes. Yeah. They're all they've got a lot of flexibility, in my opinion.
Yeah. Death Spitters and Devourers are the two regular guns. So the Death Spitter essentially being an assault heavy bolter, shorter range, but a 3-shot, three shot strength 5-1. Very, very good. I think the Devourer is only strength 4, though. Shorter range, but it's an assault weapon. You can advance and shoot with it.
Well,
and you can make the guys.
Any model can replace his Devourer with one weapon from the basic bioweapons or melee bioweapons. And then for every 3 models, one can replace its weapon with the basic bio cannons list. So you're going to, you could have a kind of standoff and you could.
Well, people talk about double shooting Hive Guard. If you're playing against a heavy infantry army and I'm bringing like 80 guardsmen, you double shoot your nine bloody Tyranid Warriors with their, and you have 3 heavy weapons. So what's that mean? You've got 6 heavy bolters in there and you double shoot that 6 times 3, 18. So you're going to have 36 heavy bolter shots coming out of this unit. And in addition to double shooting venom cannons or barbed stranglers, it's a legitimate amount of firepower. On top of that, you can give them rending claws or bone swords, or I think the lash whip and bone sword. I'm pretty sure the lash whip is not the best option anymore. Because it used to be the mainstay pull, wasn't it? In 6th and 7th edition, was a Lashwood Bonesword.
Because that's what they came with.
That's right. And it did look the coolest sometimes.
No, yeah, it was. No, you would deny attacks of people or whatever, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think double Bonesword or Rending Claws are the best options there. And honestly, probably the Venom Cannon's the way to go, because you want to keep it with a bit of duality. You can function against anti-armor, can function against things like of the ilk of Terminator Centurions, things like that. So I think the Venom Cannon's probably better. Nothing's
changed. I mean, you still have to be able to kill a knight, you know, in one turn. That's right. So, you have to do that still. Like the, I know we've talked a little bit about the wondrous and amazing things that is a new addition and what you can try, but like some things are the same. You still have to be able to, like, if they present a knight to you on turn one, you've got to be able to kill it. Otherwise, they are going to present one to you on turn one.
Man, I'm excited to like bum rush a Gallon into somebody's lines when they're playing like a dense bubbled up like shooty army and just make him explode. I think that's still just hilarious. it's just fun. I mean, for you, yeah, of course. For me,
yeah. Oh man, it's been good chat about Tyranids. I mean, I know we talked about him when the Psychic Awakening has come out, and it has, like, those things are also still pretty good, but what passes for a good troop nowadays is really worth examining.
That's really well said.
Because everything's, like, the battlefield role of things is, I mean, granted, speed bumps are still speed bumps, but the way that speed bump plays or how you layer speed bumps is an altogether different animal.
Agreed. Did you want to touch on another faction, or do you want to?
We're running close on time. I know, Reg, you've been working on a Drukhari list. I don't know if we want to touch on some of that, because they've been, I mean, we've briefly talked about them, that they kind of seem like they got the short end of the stick with points.
Yeah. So I, and to be fair, like, I haven't finished this up. I think there's a lot to still play with it, but so what I was trying to do, and I'm sure some folks might not agree, but I was trying to figure out a way. I've always, from essentially when their models were delivered back when in 5th edition, you know, their new update, because they used to have the 3rd edition models. They came out with these sleek 5th edition models, and I really bought into them back then. I've always been a big fan of the Raiders. I kind of like the space pirate, you know, them hanging off the Raiders, like in mass. And them just like doing like a almost like a drive-by shooting kind of deal of they fly by. There's 10 of them just sitting there with their guns loaded. I like the idea of splinter racks, giving them extra shots. And so I've been kind of trying to play around with how to best approach that, because, you know, we're talking about bodies and speed bumps and everything. I think that this concept of transports and the durability that vehicles provide and what that means, and being able to get out of there and being able to engage necessarily, especially with the open top vehicles, you know, so I know just efficiency wise, probably people are going to lean towards the Venoms, because they're smaller, they're kind of cheaper. But I really like 10, you know, warriors, and 10 warriors is kind of expensive. I mean, they're 9 points, which is pretty high in regards to some of the other troop choices that are out there, but with all those poison weapons, and so the looking for at the custom Cabal traits from Psychic Awakening, the one that I really like is the poison one, which is it's the Toxin Crafters. So when resolving an attack made with a poison weapon by a model with this obsession on an unmodified wound roll of 6, add 1 to the damage characteristic of that weapon for that attack. For the purpose of this obsession, a poison weapon is any weapon that has poison weapon ability. So you take all of their rifles, right? All their splinter, their poison splinter rifles. You have one of those drive up. I mean, so every wound roll of 6 unmodified, that's as long as it goes through unsaved, which is kind of the big caveat to it, because it has no AP, that's a dead Primaris there. And so there's some weight to it. And then you talk about, you know, these monsters or the larger, you know, I mean, we've Indominus just released, right? So you've got bikes that are out there. You've got things that are toughness 5. People are looking at Death Guard and their higher toughness and their resiliency and everything. To a point, you know, I understand the struggle with Drukhari to a certain extent in this regard, is that they're lacking AP. But I do think that they can add a wealth to it of being able to maneuver on something with their, whether it's Venoms or Raiders, and to be able to engage at range and without, you know, minimal with minimal penalty. The what I was looking at, the second trait was the mobile raiders, which adds 3 inches to the move characteristic of models with the succession that can fly. So you take all of those raiders or venoms, and now they're moving at, you know, I mean, I think that's 17 inches of movement, and then a 12 inch rapid fire range. I mean, it's just a lot of firepower that can be put out. And so I think that I understand that it seems kind of pricey for what they went from, but I do think that there's a lot to apply to that. And so I'm trying to figure out exactly what the right balance is. And then to have, I was a big fan of Grotesques in 8th edition. And I mean, those things are tough, right? Especially you take Prophets of the Flesh. They've got a 4+ invuln. They've got a feel no pain.
It'd be they would soak so much fire.
That's right. And so to have them, like, they're perfect, you know, like a tar pit unit to hold things down while the rest of the units are either moving to objectives and holding things down one way or the other. And there's a couple things they've got in regards of leadership, you know, the phantasm grenade launchers and things like that. Like, you just need to be able to drop leadership a little bit here and there and cause those attrition tests. And you can get a lot done with that. And so, you know, I think they've got some good possibilities. I need to keep playing around with it a little more, but I don't think that they should be discounted. I do think that there's a good mix between what they offer ranged wise and what they can do in melee.
You see the Venoms? I mean, how do you think they're functionally going to fare? We talked up vehicles a lot, especially vehicles with high rates of fire. And, you know, they have that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, they're... So they're, I mean, and they come with a 5+ invuln, and they're automatically a subtract 1 to hit rolls, right? I mean, that's kind of the typical loadout for them. If they have 2 splinter cannons, I mean, that's 2 rapid fire 3 weapons at 36 inches. So at 18 inches, you're talking about, you know, 12 shots right there. And if they're able to move, so I'm sorry, when I said their movement, so their base movement is 16 inches. And so you add that trait onto them, and they're moving 19 inches, and then at 18 inches. So that's a, you know, at rapid fire range, you're talking a total threat range of really 37 inches with that kind of mobility. That's some pretty serious movement in all cases, and they're relatively durable. I mean, they're toughness 5. I acknowledge that, but that -1 to hit and the 5+ invuln, it's not necessarily something to dismiss out of hand, I guess.
Well, I mean, toughness 5 is sometimes the equivalent of toughness 7.
It can be, yeah. I mean, exactly.
When somebody's in 5s to wound him, strength 5 is going to be something in the game, but just don't present the targets. You get that option now. I mean, obscuring terrain is a real deal.
Yeah, and threat overload, right? I think Venom Spam still has a place in the world. I don't think that it should necessarily be discounted out of hand. I think, you know, that there's some other things that can be taken advantage. This is me just because I have a lot of Cabalite warriors that I am a fan of that aesthetic. And so I'm just looking at the Cabal so far, but I know that there's a lot more in regards of Psychic Awakening. I know you might not be happy with a lot of the stuff in there, but there's definitely things that we can use together that we can still make work. I love the new Incubi models, with Drazar and everything that came out with the Phoenix box set. Like, I mean, they just look so good. Like, why wouldn't you want to find some way to make that work, you know?
That's a great point.
Yeah. I mean, Grotesques are good. Grotesques are tough and durable. I think.
But you've got to build around them. Like, you can't. You have to take the Prophets of the Flesh or the Homunculus army. You can't just sprinkle them in to a list.
That's right.
When you start including Grotesque, that becomes your list.
It does become a healthy part of it, for sure. I mean, that's where, you know, another consideration, especially with blast weapons, the Flyers and their missiles, all of their missiles for the Razor Wing jet fighter are blast weapons. They're all D6. And so, you know, you consider some of these, like we were just talking about, you know, 10-man Hormagaunt squads and whatnot. Or if you make a bigger Gene Stealer squad, I mean, Razor Wings are going to be great for managing some of that to certain extents. Because, you know, they're at least going to get 3 on those units. And if they're bigger units, they're going to get a full-on 6 hits right away. And so, you know, I think that they've got a lot of applicability. It's just this kind of brainstorming, forming, norming phase we're in with just starting off 9th edition and what's going to do what while we kind of get our gears going.
Okay, well, we're going to continue to walk through some of these factions and, you know, want to hear ideas from what's working and I mean, what is and what are the things you're most excited about doing? That's what we want to hear. And you know, we're going to talk about, of course, with the things that's exciting to us. So hopefully you want to join us on this journey.
And just touching on the Dark Elder side of things, I think players out there, a lot of you out there, look at an army and you want to know what the core is. And that's why I gravitate to trying to talk about things like those Tuned Warriors I was talking about before. And you might notice I do it in other episodes. I talk about the thing you want to try and build your army around. I think that's where there's a bit of haze with the Dark Elder. People don't quite know where to, what's the core, what's the style of the list they're trying to build around. I will admit, like, the points increases to Venoms are a little bit awkward. Like with the double spinner cannon, it goes up to 90 points. Yeah, I think that's a bit awkward. So maybe you do want to just go stick with the splinter rifle, say 15 points. You get, like, what is it, two less shots, but 15 points saved. Maybe that still buys you another venom. Right? Yeah, still poison.
Yeah, it's
still
poison. The same weapon, yeah, as far as that goes, yeah.
So maybe after you buy your third venom at that points point, at that price point, you've got enough points from other places. You buy a fifth venom, and that's just giving back all the extra shots you just missed out on, and then some, and extra wounds. But what I like is the topic we talked, you brought up before, Red, MMU, for Cabal units. I really like the idea of two or three medium-sized units of Grotesques. Like, I think that's really stable. If people want to think about a stable core to build around, you can do the same thing with Talos. Two or three men units of Talos, maybe one, you know, two or three of them, maybe not three of them. It's a bit on the crunchy side, but like a meaty, stable front. Like that's what I feel like Dark Eldar might need. They need a stable frontage to perform, to play the game from, and then they can stage these flanking maneuvers and these eating around the edges and investing their poison resources and their DACA where they need to. But yeah, it just seems like they've got this, the price for their core, the stuff you got to build a list around, got hit harder than maybe some people wanted. I still think what you're talking about, though. I like Raiders a lot this edition. I actually like Raiders a lot. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, where you just say, hey, just guys, just mass some guns that are good at clearing objectives, and you have those in spades. There's a lot to like there. I think that was really well said.
Yeah, heck yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's all our time today. We're going to continue talking about Xenos next week.
Do we want to have that little chat about what is Xenos, what isn't Xenos?
No, we'll have that be revealed. as time goes on, we may have a special interview segment next week. So again, I mentioned a bunch of exciting stuff coming down the pipe, and that is not stopping. So you're going to want to make sure that you subscribe if you haven't already. Like us, you know, I mentioned that thing about the feed. Keep checking back. We're going to be releasing something every single week, and you do not want to miss it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Where do you go from here, Paul? Like Dan Abnett, Duncan Rhodes. It's, you know, surely it's downhill from here.
It
sure.
May always be downhill, but it's always going to be good. So
as long as it's fine, if it's downhill, if it's an enjoyable ride.
We'll be all right. We'll be fine. Hang in there with us. Red, Adam, see y'all next week.
See you next week.
See you later.
Corner.